And now, Aquarimaxers, the exciting conclusion to the interview with Nick Shades. This is episode 318B.
So the filter itself, now I'm familiar with the basic concept of a Hamburg-Mountain filter, where you basically partition off a section of the tank with a permeable foam, like an open cell foam. So you're doing this on a very much smaller scale within an enclosed box, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, you can go to the grocery store, grab yourself those small little Tupperware containers. Ziploc makes them, Gladware makes them, and they're those disposable containers. All I did was I just took a simple aquarium filter, which you would normally use, not an aquarium filter, an aquarium pump, which you would use to get, let's say, like a waterfall in an outside pond. If you had an outside pond, you'd use one of those to send water up to a top rocky area and go back down. I took that and stuck it inside of one of those Ziploc containers, cut a little hole in the top, put the poly filter in where the inlet of that pump goes, and then just stuffed it into that jar. I did have to drill a small hole into the side of the jar. There's a couple different ways to seal it. I chose silicone because of how small the volume of water is, because the volume of water in any vessel, the amount of pressure or ambient PSI, I guess you could call it, is really determined only by the height of the water. In other words, you could have a dam that has, let's say, 10 million gallons of water. That dam, so long as it only goes so high, the pressure will stay the same even if that amount of water extends for miles and miles and miles behind it. Only the height of the water will change the pressure. So the same small concept in that little tiny pico jar, with only 3 gallons of water, it's only about 10 inches tall. So silicone creating a barrier around the cord, the power cord to the aquarium pump, only has so much pressure, so that silicone keeps it just fine. In a larger vessel, I would have to use something like an epoxy, a two-part water weld epoxy, in order to do that. But in this case, silicone's just fine. The only special thing that I had to do besides drilling it was I just had to cut the cord and put on a new plug after I had it go through the glass. That was the only little thing I had to work out, but it wasn't very difficult at all.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm following you so far. That makes sense. And then the so you're drilling near the bottom of the tank, or of the jar. Is that true?
Just about half an inch to 2 inches above. It in this case, for the one that I sent you pictures of, I found that those jars were pretty sturdy. Here's a little secret. I found them at World Market. They were only about $15. And I went ahead and drilled them there at the base, just above the very circular base where the curving of the jar ends, and it just is a straight cylinder. You can, generally when you're drilling tanks, it's always suggested that you drill as center as possible, because that's where the glass is going to have less of a chance to shatter or crack. However, no one ever wants to drill in the center of any piece of glass that's going to be an aquarium, because it's the least desirable place that you'd like to see anything going into it. So it was sort of a trial and error. Luckily, it was the first trial that worked out fine. I didn't shatter any of the jars that I've done. After I figured out that spot for that particular style of jar, I stuck with it, and I haven't changed the placing at all. So by keeping it the drill hole as low as possible, I can also keep the amount of substrate low as well, and increase as much water volume in there as possible.
That makes sense. So now that you, once you've got the pump in there and you've got the cord through it and everything, and you've siliconed it, now the plastic container, about how big is that plastic container? It's large enough to contain the pump itself, but do you have a specific size you always use, or do you just use different sizes depending on what you can find, or how does that work?
In the case of these jars, I have used the smallest size that I've really been able to find from specifically the Ziploc bag. Now, if anybody from Ziploc is listening, I will gladly accept any, you know, product you want to send me, but for this case, only the Ziploc brand of container has worked for me. The smallest one they make, I believe, is about 4 ounces total, and the smallest aquarium pump that I could find that would fit in there was approximately, I want to say, a 6 to 60 gallons per hour adjustable rate flow. And I've found a couple different brands of pumps that fit in there, but specifically that Ziploc brand is the smallest that I could get that would fit it, and it's the smallest they sell. Fits that pump just fine. I found a couple knockoffs of those Tupperware-style containers, but they either are too small or too big, and they take up too much valuable real estate in that Pico environment. And so by putting them, by enclosing the pump inside of them, I do actually have to cut a couple little holes inside of the Tupperware contain those Ziploc containers, and you know, sort of squeeze that that poly filter in an appropriate way so that it won't block or stall the motor, which does occasionally happen. There are times where with this whole little small ecosystem set up, that the motor will stall, and when it does, the only way to fix it without taking the whole thing apart is to get a shish kebab skewer and just sort of use it like a chopstick with, well, two of them, like a chopstick, and pull whatever is in the way of those pumps. And in the case of this jar setup, occasionally I will have some small snails that will go in there. I use mostly nerite snails to handle algae. I have used a mono shrimp as well as the Neocoridina heteropoda to handle algae, but they really only handle biofilm. But in the case of the nerites, sometimes they're just small enough that they will go down for some reason that outlet pump, and they will get stuck in that stall motor. And that can lead to the jars failing. So it is still sort of a work in progress as far as for fine-tuning it without any flaws, but that's the story of the aquarium hobby.
Very true. Very true, but that's part of the fun, too. It's a work in progress.
It's a lot of fun.
So you've got the plastic housing of the pump now, and you've got the floss in there, and I can visualize that, I think, pretty well. And then when you put the scape in so that this box is not visible, how do you arrange that with the substrate and with the hardscape and everything?
The trick to hiding it at that point, because there does have to be enough room for water to flow through that container. We'll just call it the Ziploc container from here on out. In order for that Ziploc container to process water and filter it through that Hamburg filter, it does have to have free-flowing water go to it. So the trick there is to get a good piece of driftwood and to sort of hollow it out and then drill an actual hole for the outlet in order to have water actually go out through the filter. The aquarium pumps have a direct line that comes straight out of them, goes straight up. Normally you attach like a quarter inch silicone tube or a vinyl tube to it, and then that would carry on somewhere else into another part of the aquarium or to the top of a waterfall. So in this case, all I do is I add a small tiny bit of that vinyl tube just so that it can get out of the driftwood. What I do is I take a piece of driftwood, hollow it out, pop it right on top of where that HMF filter is, and then I drill a hole down the center of the driftwood and just cover the HMF filter from there. It hides it, keeps it camouflaged. There are a couple different variations I've done. I'm working right now on a saltwater version or a marine version just to house corals. I don't want to put any fish in any of these environments. I've tried betas. they work okay, but I really am not a fan of putting betas in small environments, no smaller than 2.5 gallons. And in the case of these 3-gallon containers, if I have more substrate in them than about a gallon, I'm only giving a beta 2 gallons to swim around in. And I prefer betas to have at least about 5 gallons. But however, in the case of these saltwater jars that I'm starting to set up, corals can survive quite well, especially soft corals. Pulsing zinnias, greenstone polyps, a lot of those, even though they are live animals, they do great in low alkaline, dirty water. That's just what they love. And in this case, what I can do is I can just take live rock, which is not truly live, but it processes in the same way that a canister filter does, but it's very porous. It's almost like ceramic media, and by hollowing out a piece of live rock and sticking that HMF filter directly into it without the filter floss, it can go right underneath that rock and then just blow straight through the rock in the same way that it does through the driftwood, and then allows a lot more water volume to remain inside of that small pico jar.
That's a cool idea. I like that. Both the driftwood and the live rock way to do it. What do you use to hollow the driftwood and the live rock out?
Well, for a profession now, I am a maintenance technician, so I have all sorts of awesome power tools. All I use is a hammer drill in order to get things going on anything that's rock or calcium-based. In the case of the driftwood, I prefer to go to the local fish store and buy driftwood that's been sitting in a tank for a while. Sometimes I get a lot of cool critters that stayed on the driftwood, and they always are fun to watch sprout up in the pico jars. What they also do, by being in a tank already for a long time and already waterlogged, is they drill much easier. So I just use a, I believe, a half-inch hole boring bit, just attached to a regular drill, and just hollow it straight through, and then whatever is needed for the HMF filter in the case of the freshwater, I just use a larger hole saw, a carbide-tipped hole saw, same thing that you would use for hollowing out a hole or cutting a hole into glass. They come in a lot of different variations of sizes. Once you use them for this, they will probably not cut anything else, and I wouldn't cut glass with them again. But you can buy them in bulk on eBay for not very much, just for maybe a couple bucks a piece. And since these are cool alternatives to lamps, it's a fair sacrifice for one drill bit for one of these things to work properly. And you don't need very much room in order to hollow them out. I've also found that by just starting a hole with one of these hole saws, whether on driftwood or on live rock, once you have it started, it sort of chips away on its own. The waterlogged driftwood, after boring a hole, will pretty much split in a way that if you don't split it in half yourself and then just hollow out what's left and then sort of push it together around the filter, if it's really that difficult, it's time to find a different piece of driftwood. And the same thing goes with live rock. If the piece you're working with doesn't want to be changed, it's time to work with a different piece.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. You're just seeing what is adaptable and what's not.
Mm-hmm. And in the case of the live rock, it's usually a very easy medium to fragment. Once you do drill a portion of it, it just sort of chips away. You can tap at it with a chisel to fine cut those small pieces, but it takes care of itself. It generally will allow itself to be molded as needed.
Okay. Well, and from then on, I guess you're just adding, once you've got the driftwood in the place you want it, or the live rock or whatever, then the rest of it is more up to that particular setup and what you want to put in it.
Yeah, precisely. When I first did the jar, my first jar, that I sent you pictures of, it was really just sort of a place to see if it would work. It was really just a test procedure. That one ended up taking off a lot faster than I did. The lighting that I used for it was a real simple 3-watt LED puck light. It's designed for like under cabinets in your kitchen, just to illuminate, you know, just small little areas, whether underneath the sink and that kind of thing. When I started putting together the first jars, it wasn't a mindset I had intended to be electrically conscious or ecologically conscious, but after I put everything together and started using these small puck lights, which are very, very small profile, they hide completely under the jar's lid and they cannot be seen. They are only 3 watts, and then the aquarium pump is only 4 watts. So one of these Pico jars only generates 7 watts, which is less than a typical lamp you would have anywhere in the house.
Right.
So they're pretty effective builds overall.
Yeah. So that it doesn't cost much to run them at all. And then you were mentioning that you use them as lamps. Does that mean you run them in kind of a reverse photo period, so they're on when everything else is off?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of, I think her name's Diane Wellstead, which has a break in the very center of the photo schedule in order to keep algae from growing. The siesta period. So usually what I do is I have them running from about 5 a.m. until about 10 a.m., which is part of the day, which is pretty dark. Later on in the day from about 2, sometimes 3 o'clock until about 10 p.m. So as long as we're awake, we've at least got lights around the house. I do have a couple different variations. Like in the kitchen, we have one that's on strictly during the nighttime hours. So in case anyone goes down to the kitchen, there's at least a light there. The one in the living room is more on a standard schedule with that siesta period around the noon hour. I forgot the exact question you had, but I think that answers it a little bit.
Yeah, it does. Cool. Now, we covered that. And you mentioned some of the stocking that you've used in terms of shrimp. You've kept the mono shrimp and the red cherry shrimp or other varieties thereof, the Neocaridina heteropoda species and its various cultivars or varieties. What else, and the nerite snails, and then some other kinds of snails, what else have you stocked them with? And you said you don't really like to stock them with betta, so, what do you
like? Yeah, I have bettas in there. They do fine. I just am not a big fan of having bettas in there because it is a smaller environment. It's great. I mean, they look beautiful. Everyone loves to see, you know, a betta no matter where they are, and they do look great in there, and the bettas are very happy when they swim around because the heat is generated just within the pump itself. And no heater is required for the bettas. So I do keep a temperature, a thermostat in there, and it usually stays about 78 degrees as long as it's wintertime months or an air-conditioned room. If they get really hot if they're not in an air-conditioned room because that pump does generate quite a bit of heat. In the summertime, they can get up to about 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, there's a lot of ornamental shrimp which can tolerate that. They don't necessarily breed in those conditions, but they have a very, very good mortality rate. Bettas, on the other hand, shouldn't necessarily be in that kind of heat.
Right.
So if it's a cold environment where they're going to be, they'll be fine. But as far as for things go, I prefer just to keep it in a Wabakusa style with just algae eaters in there. I'd like to try Otocinclus, which are those small little tiny, I think they're closely related to Peclostomus, but they are a very, very selective, shrimp-friendly algae eater that's very, very tiny. And I'd like to see if they can do well in them, but I haven't tested them yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can be sensitive fish. I've kept them before, and seems to me like they might do better in larger containers, but it might be worth a try. One thing is, though, they do like to live in groups, so you'd have a hard time keeping a good number in there, probably.
Right, exactly. That's where it comes down to is any PICO environment, you're really limited to the types of organisms you can have in there. In the case of the saltwater ones that I'm trying to set up, it's a little bit easier to have like a colony of, say, zoas or pulsing zennia or any other number of soft corals in there because they don't need to move around. They're just going to eat the photosynthetic algae that provides sustenance to them and eat any organisms in the water that are small organisms. It's because these lamps are sort of a visual spectacle as much as a functional lamp. By keeping livestock that are less mobile is kind of a desire I've always shot for. But as it stands now, besides the algae eaters, yeah, I'm trying to steer away from any fish besides the bettas.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, sounds like that's a pretty good summary of your setups. That really helps me understand a little better how they are put together, and I think that will intrigue a lot of our listeners, and they'll want to try that out. So, I think we're getting close to our time to wrap up a bit, so we have a couple more questions for you, if that's all right.
Sure.
If you could give one piece of advice to beginners or to people who are thinking about getting into the hobby, what would you tell them?
Ooh, it's a great question. I would, first things first, I would take a look at my surroundings. If I was a new hobbyist to the aquarium hobby, and I would take a look at what organizations I have in my immediate area. If I live in a metropolis like Los Angeles or New York or Philadelphia, I would see what aquarium hobbyist organizations there are. There are so many great organizations associated with the local fish stores that when you go to a local fish store, and I mean as in a small mom and pop place, you can really get a good idea of other people in your immediate area who have kept fish that you might be already interested in having and know what you should buy, what you should stay away from, and from there have a lot more success.
That is a great idea.
That's good advice.
Yeah, I think that can make a big difference in all sorts of aspects of the hobby. Cool. So we would also like to ask you, you mentioned the website for Scape, and maybe you want to mention that again, and then any other social media or anything like that that you would like people to have to be able to contact you or the organizations you're affiliated with.
Sure. The organization that I'm most closely affiliated with is scapeclub.org. Which is scapeclub.org, and that is the Southern California Aquatic Plant Enthusiasts Club. We meet every month in Southern California from San Diego to Ventura and all the way from Santa Barbara to San Bernardino, which is basically a lateral and longitudinal limit of how big our organization is. I am also associated with Premier Reefs, which is at socalireefs.org, which is socalireefs.org. And both of those organizations are fantastic resources in order to step into the hobby, whether you are from the Southern California area or anywhere in the world. We have on both organizations' websites contributors from Montenegro, Serbia, Thailand, all over. I believe there are more countries represented on both of our organizations than countries that are not. So if it doesn't matter where you're located, if there's any information that you're interested in finding out, our forums are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and there is usually someone with a good answer to any question that you might have during any of those hours. And in addition to that, I am on Twitter at The Nick Shades. That's at THENICKSHADES. I'm usually blabbering about a thought I have any moment, given moment, but I can be direct messaged on there for any questions about the hobby at any time, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Excellent. Oh, that sounds like you have some excellent resources there for us.
Sure. Yeah, I'm always happy to help, and I'm glad to talk about this hobby with anybody who's willing to listen.
Well, we're really glad for the opportunity to talk to you, Nick. Thank you for joining us today. And
yeah, I really enjoyed talking to you guys. This is a wonderful experience.
It has been for us, too, and I'm sure it has been for our listeners. And those of you out there listening, make sure that you take advantage of the resources that Nick has provided. And if you try out his jar project, then let us know. You know, I'm sure he would love to hear about it, and so would we.
Yeah, and by all means, if you have any questions about it, feel free to reach me on Twitter. That's probably the easiest way to contact me. If you have any questions about it, or if you just want to short-circuit the method and ask for me to set up a materials list, or if you'd just like to order one for me, I'd be happy to put it in a box and send it out to you.
Cool. Excellent. Yeah, I know it's intrigued me. It sounds like a great project to do. I'm already thinking, can I get away with setting one of those up in my office? Maybe. So
You could do it.
That's really cool. All right, well, thanks again for joining us, Nick.
Thank you. Oh, I have one more thing to say.
Oh, sure.
May the fish be with you.
Yay!
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. To leave comments or questions that could be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.